Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable. It's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Hey everyone, it's Billy Morrison and Ozzy Osbourne here. Our new show, The Madhouse Chronicles, is dropping this April. Join us as we watch and react to the maddest internet clips. What do we discuss, Ozzy?
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, all that kind of shit.
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, and all that kinds of shit. Visit osbournemediahouse.com for early access. What do you say? Do you think it's the wildest show on the internet?
Oh.
You're in the madhouse now.
Warning. This episode contains foul language and visual elements that you can find on our social media.
You are listening to Keep It Weird, the podcast for all things strange, unusual, paranormal, supernatural, creepy, sticky, gross, scary, and everything in between. Each week, we sit down with a guest and we talk about something weird. This week, we are diving into the deep blue sea, and it is my nightmare coming true. We're going to explore the darkest depths of the sea and discuss sea creatures, both real and myth, while we throw in plenty of watery fun facts, stories, movie references, etc. So take a deep breath. We're going for a terrifying swim.
Oh my God.
My name is Lauren, and this is my co-host, Ashley.
Hi, weirdos. You always have the best openings. I need to be more creative.
I do.
I'm always like, we're keeping it weird. We talk about weird stuff. Today we're talking about this. Get used to it.
I do have a lot of fun when I write the openings. I will not lie. It's a good time. Joining us today is our brilliant friend and returning guest. Yeah. With all the marine life knowledge for us. It's Melanie.
Melanie.
Ahoy, weirdo.
Ahoy. Ahoy.
That was good.
Oh my gosh.
I can't say I thought about that for like 2 weeks. It's like, I'm going to say this.
I'm going to say
ahoy. I'm going to say ahoy, weirdo.
Here's the thing. Can this whole episode just be sea puns?
Yes.
It will devolve.
Like, instead of cursing, we'll just be like, yar.
Yar.
A lot of pirate talk.
Yes. It's going to just turn into pirates. It's not really sea puns. It's just pirates.
Walk the plank.
Walk
like, if anyone
the
says
plank.
Something we don't like, walk the plank. Melanie,
welcome, weirdos. Welcome,
why,
Melanie.
Welcome again.
Hello.
So here's the thing. When I talk about the episode that you were on with us last time, I never know how to talk about it because the title of that episode is essentially Keep It Weird, but in Armenian.
Yes. And the alphabet being its own animal unto itself.
Yeah, exactly. So when I'm like, yeah, Melanie from that like,
oh,
episode
shoot.
We did where we talked about Armenia and Ireland and Italy.
Yes.
Like, there's no, it's
the
never
foot,
just
it's
like.
It's the foot vampires episode.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's right.
Foot
that's
vampires.
A good way to describe
that's
it.
That's how
yeah.
it all
foot,
started. We can just say Armenian foot vampires?
Yeah.
That's the episode.
Melanie
that
from
about.
Armenian foot vampires.
Yes.
Yes,
exactly.
That's, I'm going to change my last name to that. It's still shorter than my actual last name.
It's still shorter than Vertebadian Minsky.
Yeah. Your last name is crazy.
it's like yeah. in the coolest way. I love
it's
it.
It's interesting. I think phonetically it's pretty okay compared to a lot of other Armenian last sure. names that have KHs and GHs, yes. which is just coming from your throat and your lungs, and most people
to,
can't
like, hack.
You know, the cats can make it happen. Yeah. But yeah, so phonetically it's pretty straightforward, but pronunciations and things are interesting because we roll our R's and we whatever, you know. So
yeah,
I usually, when I introduce myself, as I said, I just use my first name, and then I even shorten that. I was like, it's too long too. We'll just Mel is fine.
Mel's fine. We're pretty gonna go soon. It's just gonna be M.
Foot Vampire Mel.
Foot Vampire Mel. That's how she's known around the town.
And why are you our guest on this particular episode?
So I actually studied marine biology in college. Mm-hmm. Apparently, I think somewhere around the fourth grade, I did a book report, and I did it about whales, and all of a sudden that was my jam. And I think I decided at that point that, you know, at the time I was a kiddo and I loved SeaWorld. I absolutely loved it. I loved going down there. I wanted to work there, I thought, for sure. And obviously we know that's not really that's not a good
not
thing
really,
anymore.
It's not really sea friendly.
Some things, but that was sort of always my passion. So I went to school. I have a degree in marine biology. I worked at an aquarium for about 13 years.
Wow.
Teaching kids and then just talking to visitors about the ocean. It was nice because the aquarium that I worked at was very local. It's in Southern California. It's down in San Pedro, and it's actually free for visitors. We run on donation. But what was nice about that is it was very sort of friendly to the neighborhood. So kids who live within 10 miles of the water who have never seen the ocean, that was their jumping off point. Pun number one. And so that was a really fun experience. In the summers, we would go kayaking or snorkeling with kids. We would take them to the tide pools, dig in the sand for sand crabs, and give them the experience of this is really the ocean. And yeah. and for me, a big thing of just science education in general is you'll care about it if you can relate to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So absolutely. Anything as, you know, grandiose as climate change, all the way down to why shouldn't I throw trash on the floor or on the ground? All of that stuff just comes with, well, I've seen the animals, I've seen the environment. Now I can give a shit, basically. Yeah. So that's just kind of what drives me anyway. So, that's sort of what I want to do in my day-to-day life is just teaching kids about not necessarily just the ocean, but nature in general.
Because now you work at the botanical garden.
Yeah, now I work at a botanical garden and
yay,
I just,
nature.
You know, yeah, exactly. And so any setting like that for me, like a museum, somewhere that's outside of a classroom. So you're kind of introducing the natural world to kids, but it's not, you have to learn this for a test. It's just, hey, come inside. Check out these super cool dinosaur bones. If you accidentally learn something, my job is done.
Yeah.
That's right. Kind of how I approach it. Yeah. I don't want kids to come and be like, oh, it's more
this
stupid
is boring.
Stuff.
It
feels like
I don't
a classroom.
Because yeah. I've been there too. Like you would go on a field trip and you didn't do anything. You looked at dioramas behind glass.
Right.
And now a lot of these institutions are so much better about making things interactive and again, making like personal connections. So that's my jam.
I do love that. In this day and age, museums are just getting cooler and cooler. Like
they totally are.
They make everything into a show. They make things that you can touch and see up close. Like it is so different from when we were kids, and it's so much more fun.
Yeah, and museums are also like great places for adults to hang out at. Like you can now hear a live band and grab a beer.
Yeah,
you couldn't do that 15 years ago. That
was
going to
say the Natural History Museum is. They
it's
always
amazing.
Have parties.
They
it's
always
so
have
fun.
Parties. You can get married there, yep. and you can just kind of feel like it's a place that you would choose to go to for funsies,
as opposed to like we're going to the museum whether you like it or not.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Like,
it's get so in the car.
I got married in a museum.
You
in
did
museum.
At a nature
in
museum.
Chicago, but
you talked
still.
About
you
your
know,
butterfly incident.
Yes. We don't need to bring that up today.
You're like, we're here
to scare Lauren. PTSD. Oh,
yeah, this is my day to be
I have
horrified.
Butterfly PTSD. I was going to say, I think a lot of people would roll their eyes at, a lot of kind of museum snobs would roll their eyes at like what museums are becoming. But you have to understand that like, especially generations, like our generation, we're still okay. But like the generation after us who were raised, like literally raised on iPhones and raised with Netflix and raised with like so much entertainment. At all times.
Access they need more stimulation.
Yeah. Always entertained.
Have to
always stimulated.
Yeah.
that you just have to, you have to change your tactics. You can't just have a room full of pictures with absolutely. A wall of text under them.
Something just has say to the text be that you have to
interactive.
Read.
Yeah,
it something has to be interactive. To,
or else, yeah, those institutions will disappear in the next generation.
Mm-hmm. Now there's a guy in a dinosaur outfit that runs around the Natural History
it's
Museum.
It's great.
He's
thing.
Super fun, too.
It's so great. And
oh,
he's got feathers.
This has nothing to do with the sea, and I am so sorry, but I did see it today, and I posted it on our Facebook page. Did you see the Denver airport now has a talking
a
gargoyle.
Gargoyle. I was dying.
I told Joe, I was like, this is a false flag operation because this gargoyle, like, as you walk up to it, will like talk and interact with you. And the first thing it says is, welcome to the Illuminati headquarters. I mean, the Denver International.
Oh, I love that they've embraced it. I think
I do too, but I think that it's a false flag operation. I think they're just trying to throw us off the scent of the fact that is the Illuminati headquarters.
They're like, now we can openly admit it, but people will think we're joking.
People will think we're joking. This is our representative, Ted the Gargoyle.
Exactly.
To this day, that was when I think I texted Ashley after I was listening to that episode while walking down, like just walking in the neighborhood, and I was laughing so hard. I'm like, someone's going to. Think I'm insane.
Someone's gonna call the cops
because all these conspiracy things you guys were discussing, and when you got to the Denver airport, and I saw the smoke coming out of Joe's ear as his brain just
Joe was having a full
exploded.
Panic attack.
It was amazing.
His face at one point went ghost white, and he didn't even speak. Like, he didn't even have a response.
He was like too mad.
That's not real.
He was very upset about it.
Can't be real. How did I not know this airport had these things?
He like eventually was like, yeah, and they have murals about Nazis. And he was like, okay, you know what? He like threw his stuff down. He's like, I'm done.
I'm out. Stuff just in the open. It's like, yep, that's Denver.
Welcome to Denver.
Fantastic.
Ooh, one other thing I have to say before this episode comes out is that this episode that we are recording right now comes out on my birthday.
Oh, I love it.
That's actually
true.
Super
cute.
Oh, my goodness.
So we can say happy birthday, Ashley.
Thank you.
Happy birthday, Ashley.
It's a beautiful Friday, March 22nd.
March 22nd. It's probably a beautiful Friday. Yes.
Picture
but
Sicily.
Picture Los Angeles.
Yay.
2019.
Oh, that's so great.
And listeners, all I want for my birthday is a present sent to my address and also of your choosing and also an iTunes review. So head over to iTunes and leave us a whatever star you want. I'm not going to be picky.
Of the five-star variety.
Five-star would be nice.
We love five-star reviews, but I mean, be yourself.
Yeah, be yourself. Live your life and give me whatever review you think that I deserve on my birthday.
Oh, gosh.
Guilt.
Hint, hint, wink, hint, hint, wink, wink. That's all I want. Okay, so today we're talking about the deep sea. Sorry, Lauren. And
oh yeah, my dream was just to terrify a pregnant woman.
Yes, that's
what I live for.
Mel was like, we have to do it before the baby's born because I feel like it's funnier when she's crying and pregnant.
Truly hate the ocean. I appreciated though that someone, when you were advertising for this episode, a listener commented and was like, are you trying to kill Lauren?
That was so
and I was
funny.
Like, I don't even know who this person is,
that
but thank
was
you
amazing.
For knowing me. Heart
I know.
And soul.
Actually, a
I
couple people
seen.
Did. Someone else was like, what did Lauren do? I was like, she's been bad.
I felt very seen and heard.
Why do you guys hate Lauren?
I felt very seen and heard.
Today, like Lauren said, we're gonna be going over like real creatures in the ocean. Mythological creatures that are probably in the ocean, let's be honest.
They definitely could be.
And some deep sea facts, some like crazy weird stuff found in the deep sea. We're kind of going to be covering all of it. And I have a couple things. One of the most fascinating things about the deep sea is the fact that we literally don't know jack shit about it. We do. We're learning a lot more. But like still to this day, 95% of the ocean remains unexplored.
It's so
because
insane.
It's so vast and we just can't get to it.
Yeah, and right. It's hard to get to
it's
it.
It's hard to get to it. It's possible now, but
they're making the technology for it, right?
Yeah.
So that
way
we will
better.
Be able to.
Thank you, James Cameron.
James Cameron,
right.
Yeah. For
I know, which is crazy.
After Titanic, he got deep sea crazy and he was like the first person. I think someone else has been deeper than him now, and I don't remember
probably.
who they are, but he I at the time that. Was the person that went the deepest in the ocean in history, which is nuts. Mm-hmm. And then he became a hack director. So
hot takes with Ashley.
Sorry.
At least swap the deck. Titanic.
Swap
though.
The deck.
Love it.
We actually walk the plane.
James Cameron.
We know more about the surface of Mars than we do the floor of the deep ocean, which is nutso butso. It's not possible.
Nope.
And it's getting pretty urgent that we actually push deep sea exploration, and there are several reasons why. One, and this is something I just learned, the deep sea is literally the engine that controls our overall climate. The deep bottom of the ocean is what controls the climate on Earth. But we don't exactly understand how that engine works yet. And in light of climate change and the rapid melting of the ice at the poles, et cetera, it's increasing the flow of cold water into the deep sea. And we need to be able to monitor deep sea changes so we can better predict future crises or crises, if you will, such as rising sea level or extreme weather and extreme temperatures. And literally by studying the deep sea, we could be able to predict bad shit that's going to happen.
Yeah. Right. And possibly prevent it.
And possibly prevent it.
Possibly prevent it. But even just to know, to have more knowledge and be like, okay, this is the timeline we're actually looking at
here.
Yeah,
exactly.
All of you non-believers, better start buying into it.
Better start.
Because you're going to die.
Buying some parkas. Another thing, seafood may actually not be an available form of food for future generations.
That's such a bummer.
Which sucks.
I love it.
I love sushi.
I've been missing it
because
you must be
missing it. I get to have it in a couple weeks.
Oh, that's true. Is that the first thing you're going to eat? What's the first thing you're sorry, this is not deep sea related.
No,
what's the first thing you're going to eat once the baby's out?
It's funny because I literally want sushi and a glass of bourbon.
Oh, I love it. I'm down.
I've been avoiding hard liquor.
That sounds like a nice date night. Let's do it, guys.
Yeah.
And it's so funny because we did our hospital tour of the maternity ward and they said you can order food to the room after the baby's born. They have like very open policies about food coming
in. That's great. That's
and they were like, there's a sushi place down the street. That's usually the first request of a mom. And I looked at Alex and was like, you're ordering me sushi 2 hours after this baby.
This is that episode of I Love Lucy where she's craving like sardines and pistachio ice cream and stuff. And you're like, this is pretty normal. Just go get me regular sushi.
Yeah, it's just funny. Yeah, because I had sushi once during my pregnancy and it was just a California roll because that's like the only thing you can get. So I'm like, give me my spicy tuna. And if you can sneak some bourbon in, that'd be great.
That would be great.
Anyway.
That would be ideal. So seafood might not be an available form of food for future generations. And already fisheries are beginning to explore the deep sea since species closer to the surface are depleting. But we know so little about the biology of the creatures in the deep sea, so they could potentially, probably not, but potentially be dangerous to eat. And we also don't know the repercussions of depleting the deep sea's population because the deep sea is so important to pretty much the Earth in general.
Yeah.
Also, the ocean floor is littered with hydrothermal vents, and around these vents, there are valuable mineral deposits, including even silver and gold. There's so much gold in the ocean, it's insane. There are billions of tons of nodules that are rich in cobalt, nickel, and manganese, and various parties are chomping at the bit to begin mining on the ocean floor, but what we have to study what effects mining is going to have on fragile deep sea habitats, and we won't know until we get down there and explore areas that have already been mined.
Right. Yeah, it's so risky.
A couple of years ago, this is horrible, but this is another reason. A couple of years ago, it was suggested that we take our 70,000 tons of radioactive waste and store it in stainless steel cylinders buried in the deep sea in holes drilled half a mile deep in the mud in stable areas of the ocean. Stable areas meaning like nowhere near volcanoes.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
thing
nowhere
is
nowhere near the plates.
Yeah, exactly. Or the plates. But we've recently learned that there is microscopic life that deep in this mud, half a fucking mile deep into the ocean floor. There is microscopic life. So is this still a good idea to put all this radioactive waste
this
mud?
For no other reason, it could get back to people.
It could get back to people.
So much of the ocean is connected
and
to
also,
our survival.
Right.
Like what will happen if there is, you know, if there is a major leak?
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you what will happen. Godzilla because I've seen a movie. Like, just watch any movie.
Anything that comes in contact with radioactive material is going to turn into a monster and take over New York City.
Yeah. So congratulations.
But only New York City.
Only New York City. It's always New York City.
It's always New York. And then also the, you know, deep sea mining is becoming more popular. There are almost 4,000 offshore oil wells in the Gulf of Mexico alone. In 2010, there was a gigantic oil spill known as the Deepwater Horizon accident. And it's also known as the worst environmental disaster in U.S. history.
Yowza.
So far.
4.9 million barrels of crude oil ended up spilling into the ocean after the rig exploded.
Eight
national parks were threatened, along with more than 400 species that lived in the Gulf Islands and the marshlands. It's been a decade later, and the area still hasn't come close to recovering. So when are we going to have another one of those?
Right.
And what's the extent of future damage and what's the recovery time of these damages? So far, that's completely incalculable because
we just
haven't recovered
from
the last one. Mm. And the problem is that if we have destroyed so much of the Earth's dry surface, eventually we might have to use the untouched deep sea as a vital source of food and minerals. And if we destroy it,
then
before
what do we
absolutely need it,
we got nothing.
We're trash. Basically, humans are trash. And
humans
that's
are trash. We're destroying everything we have.
Anytime we have a nature episode, it's like,
all right, guys, wrap up the podcast. We're done here. It's
we're
over.
Done here because humans are garbage. Yep. And that's the message that I'm putting out in the world.
Yep.
So the deep sea is super fucking important to us in our everyday lives.
It
and
is.
You wouldn't know it because you haven't been there and neither have a lot of people.
Most people have
not been there.
So unexplored.
I do feel like it's one of those where, like, more astronauts have been sent into space than researchers have been down that deep.
Yeah.
It's just,
that's so weird.
It's so much harder, apparently, to get to there than it is up in the sky.
Yeah, we're just shooting people up into the stars, but we can't get to the bottom of the ocean. It's just a crazy thing.
It's amazing.
It costs about the same.
Yeah, it really does.
To get someone into that deep of the ocean. I actually have a story, if you guys don't mind.
Go for it.
I do mind.
Mel mind. Sorry, listeners.
Mel mind, so
Mel,
shut
put
it
her
down.
Foot down. Swab the deck.
To the poop deck with you.
Oh, no.
I wanted to look into deep sea mining. When I read all of that stuff about, like, the problems with deep sea mining and everything, and I found a really fascinating story about how we actually got deep sea mining today. So in 1968, Soviet submarine K-129 sank about 1,500 miles from Hawaii, carrying ballistic nuclear missiles. The Russians deployed a massive search, but an American network of underwater listening posts ended up discovering the wreckage first. It was 3 miles down, which was deeper than any salvage operation that had ever been attempted before that. But it also contained Moscow's nuclear missiles, their top secret code books, like the access to their naval communications. This was a Cold War, like, they really wanted it.
Shit was real.
So the CIA hatched a plan to retrieve the submarine, and the plan was called Project Azorian, but it had to be done without the Russians knowing about it.
Right.
So they had to create a smokescreen. They decided to pretend to be exploring the possibility of deep sea mining, which at that point was just theoretical. Like, mm-hmm. they had never done it before. A PR campaign conveyed an effort to find these manganese nodules, which were big rocks scattered on the deep sea floor near those hydrothermal vents that I talked about earlier. But there had to be a front man, someone rich and eccentric enough for this to be plausible. Mm-hmm. So they got Howard Hughes.
Oh, my God.
To design the ship.
Of course.
And the ship was actually called the Hughes Glomar Explorer.
Oh.
And he agreed, obviously.
No spruce goose.
Yeah, he's batshit. So, of course, he agreed. And they built the vessel. And it was fitted with everything needed to dig up the seabed. Of course, it also had enormous doors in the hull that could swing apart to create a moon pool, which is an underwater opening large enough to accommodate the Soviet sub and keep it hidden case anyone checked their ship for a missing Soviet sub, for example. Tucked away inside the ship was a capture vehicle, which had a giant set of claws to straddle the sub and secure it and pull it up into the vessel. So this all took 6 years.
6 years.
Goodness. I mean, they had to invent shit.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it makes sense. It's just like, damn.
I know. They had to literally invent things and build the vessel.
Build them.
Like, how did the Soviets not get there first after 6 years?
They didn't know where their ship was.
That's
their shipwreck was. So they kind of knew like whereabouts, but we knew exactly where it was.
That's amazing.
So the CIA spent $500 million on this, which is approximately what it would have cost to send a man to the moon at that time.
Oh, man.
And their cover with Howard Hughes and the deep sea mining was so good that it prompted U.S. universities to begin offering courses on deep sea mining and also whipped up the share prices of all the companies involved.
Wow, man.
And basically, people thought, if Howard Hughes is into it, we need to be into it, too.
We got to do it.
Sure.
So the mission ended up being not successful at all. Mm-hmm. It didn't work. Basically, the project needed super calm weather to pull it off. But just when they were about to begin the actual retrieval, in 1974, Nixon was visiting Moscow for a peacemaking summit.
Oops.
And being caught stealing a Soviet sub would have been a fucking disaster while he was there.
Wouldn't have been great.
So Nixon insisted that the operation not begin until he left Russia. So it pushed them back into pretty turbulent weather. And due to that, the giant steel claws, when they finally seized the sub, a part of the claw snapped off due to strain. And only the front of the sub made it up. The bodies of 6 Soviet submariners were recovered and given a formal burial at sea. 98 men died on that ship. 92 of them are still down there. And the secret codes and missiles were never found. But because they were actually able to bring back samples and prove that it could be done, today we have deep sea mining.
Oh,
that's
fascinating.
So that's fucking wild.
It is wild. That's amazing.
So I mean, I'm glad that was born out of that.
If we want to invent something, we have to do it in the name of war.
Yep.
Sounds about, I mean, that's how we get business done,
right?
That's
how things work, yeah.
that's where all the money is.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
It's sort of like trying to invent some sort of technology used for war and then realizing, like, it's like inventing the Jeep. It's like, we actually have something here. This is good. Outside
this
of war.
Can, this
Let's
can take
use
your
this.
Children around. Yeah.
Let's pass it on to Mel.
Okay.
Tell us some boring science stuff.
Yeah. So I was just gonna say, like, before I get into the funner things, if you will, quote, you know, air quotes for Lauren. So I'm gonna try to do a quick background on how the ocean is divided up. So you can really think about its light, its pressure, it's the availability of food and oxygen, and that's kind of what determines what can survive at those crazy depths. So light can only really penetrate the ocean about the first 200 meters, and that's not very far at all. And that's where most of, you know, big pieces of algae, like the kelp that we see, and also where phytoplankton can survive. And phytoplankton is microscopic algae that operates just like plants on land. You know, they take in carbon dioxide and nutrients and sun, and they produce oxygen, essentially. It's the base of the ocean food chain, as you might imagine, just like, again, plants on land. And phytoplankton produces about 30% of the Earth's available oxygen.
Oh, wow.
So again, just on the surface, without the ocean, we wouldn't be here, basically. Right. So most of the larger algae can only really grow near the coast because it needs nutrients to grow, and a lot of runoff provides a lot of those nutrients. So
too much
fertilizer is bad, but the normal amount that would naturally run off into the ocean is what essentially causes large pieces of algae to be able to grow, which in turn provides habitats for very many coastline organisms. Think of a forest on land versus a forest in the ocean made of seaweed instead of trees.
Okay.
So that's kind of where we're talking in terms of where most of our oxygen comes from. So that zone, sort of the surface, is called the photic zone, where light can reach.
Okay.
And then from about 200 to about 1,000 meters is what they call the twilight zone of the ocean.
Ooh.
Right? That's the spooky zone.
Yes.
Spooky.
So light is limited. There's some light, and about 20% of organic matter that normally lives near the surface finds its way there. So stuff dies, it starts to kind of fall, and a lot of those organisms in there have these funky adaptations that allow them to survive there. Most of that stuff is what scientists call nekton, so not plankton. Plankton just floats around and it goes wherever the current takes it. So think jellies. Tiny organisms like plankton, they just go where the water takes them. They don't have muscles or they're not large enough
with
to
the flow.
Control mm-hmm. their...
What kind of plankton work in like burger restaurants?
Yes.
So and have evil plans.
That probably, in all honesty, is most closely... It's like some kind of crustacean. Mm. So possibly like krill, which is what a lot of whales would eat.
Yes.
So... the name of the gentleman, may he rest in peace. I cannot remember the creator's name of SpongeBob, who recently passed away.
Yeah, I forgot. Oh, right.
He actually also had a degree in marine biology. So it was really interesting. So when you watch, he did. And
I
so
love
when,
that.
When you watch SpongeBob, there's actually like, again, science accidentally just leaks through into kids because yes, sponges don't live in a pineapple at the bottom of the sea, but there's some actual science kind of warped into it. So it was really interesting. And that's where he got a lot of his inspiration from. Mm. Yeah, so that's kind of a fun little thing about SpongeBob, which made a lot of children interested in the ocean,
right.
Much like Finding Nemo. You know,
yeah.
It comes from somewhere.
Actually, I have a Finding Nemo one. So sea turtles, you know how the sea turtles in Finding Nemo were like, "What's up, dude?" they were like sort of like stony sounding.
Yeah.
It's because sea turtles have actually figured out that they can eat jellyfish and it will get them stoned.
Yeah.
Like it'll actually get them high. Like they don't eat it for nutritional purposes. Yeah. Like they eat it to get high.
They have no nutritional value. Like jellies are just basically like one cell thick.
Yeah.
And they just plop around for maybe 2 weeks and then their bodies are so not there that they just fall apart in the ocean. That's just what they are. So they don't actively control their movement. They just go where the water takes them. Versus things like nekton, which are organisms that decide where they're going.
Mm-hmm.
A lot. It could be a sea star that crawls. It could be a crab that crawls or a fish that actively swims and decides. So in this Twilight Zone, we're mostly talking about fish or whales, things like that, that can decide where they're squid. You know, they're moving from place to place. And there's not a lot of... stuff to grab onto because it's the open ocean, but it's not necessarily deep, so there's nothing to hold on to.
Yeah.
So that's kind of that whole Twilight Zone-y thing.
Okay.
And then a little bit deeper today, which is what we're talking about, is again what actually researchers do call the midnight zone of the ocean. So only about 5% of what's near the surface will actually find its way down. So food is very scarce. And other than the occasional large organism, like say a shark or a whale falling down that deep, which is kind of just like an accidental buffet, basically, organisms don't feed very often. They have very slow metabolism or they have different ways of gathering nutrients or just holding on to nutrients in their body that allow them to survive. They don't breathe very much, so they don't exercise a lot of energy so that they're not hungry all the time, which is essentially why food is there.
Yeah.
There's absolutely no light in that zone. It's completely pitch black. So and it's absolutely massive, which we've already talked about a little bit, is that finding each other is very difficult. So a lot of the adaptations that these deep sea organisms have to do with potentially finding a mate for reproductive purposes.
Yeah, right.
If you live in such a huge, vast, deep, dark place and you accidentally run into a species of your own kind, you best be ready.
Yeah.
Because you may not find them again for
time to get however
hitched. Long your that lifespan makes, is.
That right? makes yeah. the saying yeah, there are other fish in the sea really depressing.
Yeah.
It's like, right, well, am I in the midnight zone? Because then that's
then there's
shitty.
Not really.
Yeah.
And I then won't find one for years. What is the loneliest number?
And then really briefly, the trenches that we know of, you know, we're literally talking the deepest portions of the ocean. Scientists have actually called the Hadal Zone, named after Hades, you know, the Greek god of the underworld, which I think...
Ooh, that's kind of fun.
Scientists have a sense of humor, guys.
I
will not accept otherwise. And then along with no light, pressure is an issue because that's one of the reasons it's so hard to get down there is because... Imagine you're walking around in air, no big deal. The deeper you go in the ocean, the more water is on top of you and the more it presses down. So your organs don't function properly and all that kind of stuff. So organisms that live down very deep cannot survive near the surface because they're adapted to surviving that far down. So you don't usually see like crazy deep sea creatures in an aquarium because they can't survive unless they have very specialized pressurized tanks. Mm-hmm. It's super cold down there, but it's stable. So the water temperature doesn't change. Mm-hmm. And then at the hydrothermal vents, obviously, that's really different. It's crazy hot because there's like magma basically coming out of the ocean. But there's like sulfur and all these crazy other gases down there. But because the water won't boil because of all the pressure, it's really interesting. So there's no steam being created. It's weird between pressure and temperature and physics and moving on.
It's really wild watching. Did you watch, what's it called? It's sort of like the planet Earth, but Blue Planet.
Blue Planet. Yo,
the deep sea episode is
they're crazy.
It's nuts. And it's not just like, look at these crazy creatures. It's things like seeing the small animals that do feed on the hydrothermal vents.
Yeah.
And it's like they have to zip in, grab something, and they literally get burned alive.
Yeah, right. Pretty much.
Like if they like so one quick. Slip up and you're burned alive, yeah, and it's right, like, goodness.
The pressure.
I could just go to McDonald's.
The pressure is literal and figurative. Yeah. The pressure.
Yes.
There's very the pressure. True. And then real quickly, when it comes to light, if you are looking in the ocean, it's interesting because if some of these deep sea creatures, when they've been pulled up to the surface, they've discovered that very many of them, unless they're essentially transparent or black and gray, like just kind of more dull colors, they're actually red because red wavelengths disappear the fastest in the water. So again, bear with me a bit on the physics here. Mm-hmm. So what we see is visible light, which is between infrared and ultraviolet. So colors with the longer wavelengths, things like reds, oranges, yellows, they disappear faster in water. And then those with the shorter wavelengths, so greens, blues, purples, can travel further. So it seems kind of counterintuitive, but they have bright colors sometimes because you just cannot see that far down. So if you're kind of in that middle, like twilighty zone where there's some light, mm-hmm. those red creatures don't appear at all, versus if you're kind of like a greenish blue, you might actually stand out in the water, even though, I mean, water is clear, obviously. We know it's not actually blue, but the idea being that if you are that color, you're going to be seen potentially by a predator.
Right.
And we talked a little bit about how expensive it can be. So there's still a lot we're still discovering about the geology of the deep sea, the biology of the deep sea. Mm-hmm. And so what I wanted to talk a little bit about today is how light is produced in the ocean, because we see a lot of these crazy pictures of these really crazy looking deep sea creatures that produce light.
That literally glow.
That literally glow. And again, a Finding Nemo reference, which is super great. It's very accurate, is anglerfish. You use bright light to lure
they
things.
They have that bulb on top of their head, yeah. right? I can't believe that's real.
And that idea that it's a shiny, shimmering thing and let me go near it. And it's totally accurate. Again, I mean, just think of a shiny bauble and even a baby or a cat being mesmerized by it in the deep sea when you don't see light and suddenly you're like,
What is that?
Ooh, you know, and you have to go towards it. And then now, because
I mean, it's the same as like bugs being attracted to light.
Yeah.
So getting like a bug light.
And then they get sizzled. Yeah. Yeah. It's but like, the idea is,
don't go into the light. Yeah. I can't help it.
It's so beautiful.
So I'm going to talk a little bit quickly about how organisms produce light. And then couple of these really unique deep sea habitats like whale falls. And then because it's, you know, called Keep It Weird. And if I don't, you know, talk about the weird stuff, then what am I doing here? So I titled that segment The Creature Feature. And so that'll be near the end. And then
hopefully
Lauren doesn't punch me from the chair. Like, don't show me that. You know,
don't show me that picture.
So there's no natural sunlight, obviously, that far down deep in the ocean. So certain organisms are capable of producing their own light. And there's a couple ways that can happen, biologically speaking. The most familiar is bioluminescence. That is basically organic ability to produce light. And usually it's actually a chemical reaction happening in the tissue of certain organisms. Some fish actually have bacteria that produce the chemical and they glow, and that bacteria will live
on the skin of the fish, on the tissue inside the scales.
Oh, interesting.
So the fish doesn't create its light, but what lives on it does. And so it's an interesting, like a mutualistic relationship. So the bacteria have somewhere to grow and the fish benefit from the light they produce. And oftentimes that's maybe used for communication between, you know, similar species and things like that, or for reproductive purposes. So it's a chemical reaction, and it's called bioluminescence when it happens in a living organism. And there's a lot of that in the ocean. Not necessarily all of it is crazy deep, but much of it is. And these reactions happen. It has nothing to do with light shining on them because there is no light down there. So it's just a chemical reaction.
It's not
happening.
Like the schools of fish that will use their literal like light shining off their scales to throw off predators.
Yeah. And so it's not that's like happening that.
They actually produce
surface.
Light.
Yeah, which is amazing. And
it
so
is amazing.
Fluorescence is kind of that idea where you're actually absorbing and reflecting light. So that, of course, can happen as well. And a lot of times that happens and it's reflected as a different color. So it depends on what gets absorbed. So kind of think of black lights. You know, you're shining a black light onto a certain surface and like whites appear kind of that funky green and they're really bright looking and all that kind of
and
stuff.
And semen appears like it's glowing.
In hotel rooms. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, that's
blood,
why you don't.
Like whatever you want to talk about.
That's why you don't, you know, sit on that bed cover thingy and you just throw it in the corner.
What was that? Hey, what was that MTV show? Where they got to like break into the guy's room.
Oh yeah, oh, what was God. That called? Was they'd that like called? Throw the guys in a van, and
yeah,
then the
they
girl
like,
would go explore.
Or a girl,
and she'd do
and
black
like the
light exploring.
The guy or the girl that could like go into the bedroom and like and, see how messy oh, yeah. it was. Or...
And then she'd take the black light to things, and sometimes it was so gross. No, I want to know what the name of that is. We'll have to look it up.
We're
later.
Gonna find that out.
Anyways.
That was hilarious. I loved that joke.
So yeah, so some organisms that can fluoresce, it's usually, again, communication related or to attract prey, provide visual cues, things of that nature. And that's kind of a byproduct of just an animal's ability to adapt. It doesn't necessarily... like the bioluminescence is things that have taken like millions and millions of years to evolve versus, interestingly, the idea that this fluorescence was like an accidental, oh, hey, this works. And so adaptations just kind of happen versus evolution is like, oh, we're all keep dying, but one of us keeps surviving because this guy glows in the dark.
Right.
So more of that guy's genes are going to get passed on over thousands and thousands of years and they're going to evolve to survive. And then there's phosphorescence, which just real quick, it's the ability of something to emit light for a much longer time after the light is gone. So like glowing hands on watches, that's the idea of phosphorescence. Like it's exposed to sunlight for a very long period of time.
Okay.
And then in the dark hours later, that light shines back. And
it's like those stars you put on your ceiling.
Yes, absolutely.
Like they take in the light all day and then they glow at night.
Yeah. So mostly we're talking about bioluminescence when we're talking about marine organisms, whether it's deep sea stuff or not. So some, like I said, some fish, it's mostly fish, but some organisms have these little tiny individual cells. They're called photophores. So they're light producing cells and they have spots, dots along their body, and then others will borrow light from, say, bacteria, or there's a bunch of these photophores concentrated in one area like the lure on an anglerfish. So they're tiny little cells and they just all clump together for a specific purpose. So not a whole lot is known about how the organisms produce this ability, and again, that's partly because it's so hard to study them.
Yeah.
And then if you turn on a bright light, they don't look like they did in the deep ocean. So if you want to, even in the deep ocean, if you shine a light on an animal with like a submersible, it doesn't look like that anymore because it only looks like that in the dark. So how do you study something in the dark when we depend on our eyesight to see?
Yeah.
Yeah. To be
and
able
how are you
going to
gonna figure out and study the organism or it stops producing that ability once it's dead?
Yeah.
So there's some challenges, of course, involved in that. A lot of the organisms themselves are light sensitive. So because the light they emit is not sunlight or light that we use in a lamp. So if you shine that on them, a lot of them just freak out. They can't survive that either. So it's just really interesting that there's some studies being done. Fireflies are a nice example of bioluminescence on land. And it's a similar process. And you can study fireflies and then potentially use that information to make pretty educated guesses about what's going on in the ocean. But a really interesting phenomenon that you can see here, I mean, anywhere with a coastline almost, is there is a species of microalgae. Well, there's more than one species, but there's a very common one here in Southern California. It's called Noctiluca, and they produce their own light. They bioluminesce, and there are these tiny little single-celled little creatures, and when they're agitated, they shine a light, basically. They emit a light because they're stressed out. That's just what's happening. And it's not necessary that you're going in there and shaking it up. When the water moves in the waves, that's right. enough to cause
that's
them
enough of a stress. Stress.
Yeah. If you're yay big, then a wave is, oh. Yeah,
if you're
so.
Yay big or your name is Ashley Cassidy, yeah. the smallest wave
you'll
can
be
cause
stress.
Yes. So they have that ability. It's really amazing. You can walk along the beach and you can create these brilliant trails of light as you walk because it's like behind you. It's like trailing behind you if you're just walking right along in the sand. And historically, these blooms, these algae blooms were called sparkle of the sea or burning of the sea, of course, when, you know, we didn't know any better. So it's a common species of dinoflagellate, which, okay. So, sorry, more science. So phytoplankton is the plant plankton, if you will, and zooplankton is the animal plankton, and dinoflagellates are somewhere in the middle because they're neither here nor there. They produce, much like plants on land and other algae, they are capable of photosynthesis and they use all those nutrients and sunlight and water to create oxygen, but they can also kind of move on their own. Again, if you're talking
they're
about-
They're like Venus flytraps.
Yeah. If you're talking about like moving in waves, yeah, they go where the water takes them. But locally, they can control-ish where they go because they have these funky little appendages called flagella. And if you think about moving a yo-yo up and down, it's like that. It's like a ripcord. It just spins them around in the middle of their body and then they just kind of twirl around in the water, which is
fun,
real funky. And then they have another little flagella, which is kind of like how they grab nutrients and or food out of the water. So it's not super passive, but it's not technically an animal, and that's why we don't just talk about the, you know, the kingdoms and blah blah blah. It's very different now, especially as we've discovered more about the ocean, that not everything can just be easily divided into these are bacteria, these are plants, these are animals, and that's it. It's all we have. Turns out there's all kinds of fun stuff in between. Yeah, so it's really cool. They're super tiny. They look like little discs.
See, this isn't too bad yet.
Yeah,
you're warming me up.
I'm easing you guys in. This is what it looks like.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
That looks beautiful.
It's really pretty. It's really, really beautiful. And
gorgeous.
So we go from
Can you see in my glasses?
Yes, I can.
From these beautiful little scenes of the ocean, and then that's we get lovely. Into the scary shit. No, not yet. But yes, anyway. So
can deal with the pretty glowing discs.
I can handle that. And then this, for example, is a shrimp that would flashlight to scare away a predator.
Okay.
So some organisms do it for that reason. Yeah. Obviously, if something approaches and you're tiny, but you can turn on a light really quick and the animal's like, no, thank you.
I don't want to
They'll swim away and look for something else. So camouflage is obviously a very common way to protect yourself in the ocean. Mm-hmm. So if you can't cover up your body in some way, light is really helpful. Or, for example, the reason a lot of fish have dots and bars and bands on their body or different colors is because it breaks up the overall body of the animal. It's harder to see it because, you know, I mean, if you're in the shallows, you can kind of see in the water. Fish can see other fish. But if the body outline is broken up and the colors are all weird, it's like, is that a fish? Is that a rock? And then that's why other senses are so much more powerful than their eyesight, because really it's not. So this is an interesting little fishy, and it's not too bad, but it's called a blue lantern fish. And it's actually found in the eastern Pacific, so closer to where we are. And the reason this fish is cool is because it's small, but its photophores are huge, like these big dots that you see along the – and it's mostly on the belly of the body.
Those dots are actually on its body?
Yeah.
That wasn't – it looks like it was drawn on.
It looks
on.
Like
they're
it was
insane.
Drawn on, and there's these huge little dots. And they're located on the bottom side of the fish, and it helps to break up the outline of the fish. But researchers think it's basically for communication, so you find another one of your own. So these patterns sort of are unique to each individual, but there are common patterns among the same species. So if they find each other in the water, they know that that's the same species. Okay. And most fish, do something called broadcast spawning. So they're not, there's not internal fertilization. The female releases her eggs and the male releases the sperm and they just kind of mix in the water. That's one of the reasons some fish will school is so that reproduction is easier and you're mixing a lot of genetic material in the water and then making more of yourself. So one of the reasons they have this stuff is so that they can essentially communicate with one another when there's no other way, when it's so pitch black that without any kind of light, it wouldn't be possible. Okay.
Hate this guy.
Gird your loins.
I mean, I've seen him before, okay, so there's no shock and awe, but I hate him every time I see him, and I don't believe that he's real.
Who is he?
It's an anglerfish.
Oh, like, yes. I am so sorry. Teeth,
and you have a light bulb sticking out of your head. Like, what? Who made you? I don't. He shouldn't.
This is why there is no God. You know, there's he wouldn't no make these.
He wouldn't put that near me.
So anglerfish is they're a large group of different fish of different species that have this similar style. They have these big, weird looking bodies with this lure over their head. And there's
ugly,
all kinds of
toothy smiles.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so at the aquarium I worked at, we had a preserved specimen of one called a football fish. And obviously it's just in like a big, you know, preserved tank. But it was super ugly. It had like these beady little eyes because it doesn't see anything. It's essentially blind, but you could kind of see not only did it have the light on the end, but it would have these like things that hung down from it, like lures on a fishing line. So that again, it's like shiny wavy things. And then an animal comes close and then this big open mouth just happens.
Ugh.
Yeah. So
it's brutal when it
comes,
there.
When it comes to deep sea sexy time.
Oh,
okay.
How does the anglerfish get any?
Yeah, so again, most organisms do the broadcast spawning. Sea stars do it, you know, sponges do it, blah, 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 blah. And so the magic just kind of happens in the water. Not all fish. Some have internal fertilization. Da, 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 da. But for many of the organisms in the deep sea, the same concept exists, except, again, it's a huge amount of space. What do you do if you find another of your species?
Yeah.
And what if you're not mature yet? What if you're not ready to give up the goods because you don't have any? So in the case of anglerfish, all right, the big ugly thing you're seeing, those are all females.
Poor.
Oh,
they're all ladies.
No.
The males are probably about 3 to 4 inches. That's as big as they grow. And they found this really interesting way to survive. So
do they look the same, just smaller?
Not exactly. Do you see that thing underneath at the bottom?
Yes.
That's a male.
What? Thought that was so part of her.
I apologize, listeners. This is a bit of a visual thing, but I'm going to have
we'll
to share these
some
photos. Because
we'll
this is
he's
called
so
a female black sea devil, and she's got a male attached to her. So
is he like doing things?
Well, he might do things, but if he's not ready to do things, he doesn't want to lose the female.
Oh, so he just hangs around.
So he will basically chomp into her body. Bury himself like gills deep and just spend the rest of his life attached onto her. And now he's just a useless man on the couch the rest of his life. Doesn't feed, doesn't breathe. All of the nutrients takes it in from the female. And one single female anglerfish can have 2 to 3 to 4 males attached because she's big and blobby. And these males are tiny and weak and pathetic. So, guys, the greatest feminist of all time, apparently, is the anglerfish. But
I know, I appreciate her a bit more now.
But it's insane that that's how they've figured out how to survive and make more of themselves is, okay, you're going to stay tiny and just cling to me for the rest of your life. And when I'm ready and you're ready, we'll just release our organisms into the water.
She looks pissed he's on there.
Maybe that's why they're so angry.
Maybe that's why they look the way they do.
No, that's what
because
I'm saying.
They've
I'm
just
like
had
starting
to support
to,
men their
I'm
whole life.
Starting to appreciate her. She has this asshole mooching onto her belly and she's like, why? That's what it looks like she's saying.
Another great feminist of the ocean is clownfish.
Oh, clownfish.
Yes.
Clownfish. The men take care of the eggs once they're laid, but they also do all of the housework.
Right.
So in their like sea anemones, they
Garibaldi
have to
are the same.
An anemone. They
That's
have
why
to
Marlin
like
Marlin was so hands on, wasn't that?
Super hands on Marlin. On dad. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, they have to clean everything. They have to
Have to make the nest look pretty for the female to choose to lay her eggs there. Guys, again, the animal kingdom, every other species but humans have it right. Like the birds, all the pretty flashy ones everyone's all males.
Yeah. Yeah.
The women are like, I'm going to sit here. You look you hot for me. You put on your show. Lions have those fancy manes. Yeah, and then the women just sit there. And then here we are like, I got to shower. I got to shave. I got to put on makeup. Where did we go wrong?
Why
are we the show?
Why can't we be like the anglerfish? Yeah.
Here's the thing, though. We haven't been around nearly as long as any of these creatures. Hey, you're right.
We haven't learned yet.
We haven't learned yet.
We're going to get there.
We'll get there, guys.
We're going to let all of our hair grow.
Real quick. So we talked a little bit about, hydrothermal vents and the concepts behind them. So there's not much more to say about that, but I do want to touch a little bit about where you find them, and essentially you're finding them at tectonic plates. So where the plates meet each other, much like how earthquakes on land happen.
Yeah.
That's okay. Where you're talking about where you find things like the trenches, because that's one plate going beneath another. And the same idea is if the two plates converge and touch each other, that's where you get deep sea volcanoes, potentially volcanoes. Islands, which is how Hawaii was created, and things like hydrothermal vents. So they come out of the ground and all these crazy gases and metals are coming out and they're reacting to ocean water, which is very rich in its own minerals. And there's that thing called the Great Pacific Ring of Fire. So between talking all the way from Australia up to Japan and Russia and then over to Alaska and down all the way to South America, tons and tons of geologic activity under the ocean, because that's where so many plates converge and touch each other or come apart from each other. And that's where you get all this crazy deep sea geological activity, which then would lead to biological activity, because animals have found a way to survive absolutely everywhere.
Yep. Yes.
Some being those crazy hot spots, which you would never think something would be able to survive. But
they are literally teeming with life.
It's kind of fascinating. It's you know, finding the right resources is good. So there's lots of cool imagery and videos now of these crazy deep sea discoveries. And when some of these institutes will go out on their submersibles, now they also have the technology to allow, not in real time necessarily, but they can send back video and they can update video logs all the time of what they're finding while people are still down there, which is really amazing.
Like
20 years ago, you couldn't do that, which is so cool to see that technology obviously goes hand in hand with making these discoveries. And it's just super cool.
Well, that's also really another reason that's important to study the deep sea, is to better understand things like Mars, Saturn, Jupiter, because those planets, you're sitting there going, well, there's no way that anything exists on them because of, you know, their landscape or their temperature or, you know, what the atmosphere is made out of. And it's like, well, if you go to the deep sea, all bets are off.
Yeah.
Because they literally exist. I'm told, like I said earlier, they exist 3 miles deep into the mud.
It's deeper than Everest is tall.
So exactly.
Some of those trenches, like
the Mariana Trench.
Yeah, you can flip Everest over and still have room.
And have some space.
So that's so
I think it was if you put Mount Everest in the Mariana Trench and stood at the peak, you'd still have to swim 15 miles. To the surface
is it crazy.
That might be wrong.
I think I might have that somewhere in my notes as well. And if I come across it, but it is something
it's wild.
And that again isn't necessarily what we're talking about so much today. That's even so much deeper than the organisms that are like funky looking and scary looking.
Who knows what's down there?
I don't want to know. It's incredible. It's just crazy. I'm fascinated.
I mean, it's very cool. We're getting the technology to go down there, but like, I don't think I want to see what can survive down there.
Just don't show me.
That's too deep.
I'm sure it's cool. I don't want to know about it.
Just don't show me any footage.
And then the last little bit of, in terms of weird environments, if you will, in the deep sea, are whale falls. So whales are these absolutely massive creatures, the biggest organisms ever to have lived on in the world, and they can't survive on land because they're just too heavy, you know. But when a whale dies, if it doesn't get completely decomposed and eaten up while it's sinking, it could fall into the deep, dark ocean and just land on the bottom. And it's really interesting that the different stages in the decomposition of this whale's body, of the carcass, will support different organisms. And so scavengers will come and eat the soft tissue. So, you know, the muscle and stuff like that in a matter of months. And then other bits and pieces could take years to feed. And then, you know, quite literally, you know, sucking the marrow out of the bone of this enormous animal could support the life of so much that's deep down in there. And so for decades to come, the hard surface will act as a place for things to grow.
Yeah.
And then as it leaches out the minerals from that huge, huge body, organisms or bacteria that feed on the dead stuff, on the decay, will also start to grow as well. So you can have like a microhabitat island in the deep dark ocean because a whale's body fell and different aspects of the whale support so much life, so much different life that far down into the ocean. Yeah. So it's like a brand new food web, and it's a brand new source of energy for single celled animals, multi-cell animals. It's just kind of amazing. And then it's almost like a deep sea coral reef will start to form.
Yeah.
Wow. Which is something that does happen. We most often think of corals in like shallow, really like brightly lit waters. Right. And yes, that's absolutely true. And we're destroying those too because humans are trash. Yeah, back to the original theme of this topic here. But you can have deep sea corals. They're not necessarily dependent on sunlight.
And they're not super pretty.
They're not necessarily pretty. Yeah. But instead of having algae live in them that provide them nutrients because there's no sun, you'll have bacteria living in the corals, and that gives them enough food to survive. And the bacteria have a safe place, quote unquote, to live. They just live in the tissue of these deep sea corals. And there's some really cool photography, or photographs, I should say, from it was a 2002 exploration of a whale fall off the coast of Monterey Bay. So the Monterey Bay Aquarium is not only just an awesome institution, it has a really amazing, it's called the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, MBARI, and they go out on expeditions all the time, and they will send videos and photographs back. So you can kind of see there's, you see the overall body, like the bones of the whale, and you
so
see
that's the carcass,
all
of the
kinds
whale
of stuff just growing
coming
out
of it.
It's kind of amazing.
It is.
Yeah. Oh, there it is. So the trenches, I did find it. So as deep as 36,000 feet, whereas Mount Everest is 29,000 feet high. So it's another 7,000 feet deeper. It's really it is really deep.
It's just so deep.
Okay.
It's
so deep. Yeah.
So it's more like 1 mile.
Yeah.
So if you're standing on the tip of Everest, you still have to swim a mile to the surface.
Which
bananas.
Is still
insane. Yeah.
Very
I mean, with 15
deep.
Miles, you blew my mind, but a mile is nothing
well,
to
like,
scoff at.
Walking a mile is like, oof. And then swimming a mile is, oh, God. And then swimming up or down a mile is just
impossible. Humanly impossible.
Yeah, we can't humanly
do
that. Impossible.
Yeah, you would.
So yeah, this
your
is,
brain would
this
explode
was just kind of sort of a primer, if you will, of the physics involved in being able to survive in the deep sea with like pressure and light and the lack of food, the potential lack of oxygen. Although, again, there's a lot of oxygen in dark in deep water because the colder it is, the more oxygen it holds.
Yeah.
The warmer water gets the less oxygen it can hold, which is one of the many ways that climate change is terrible is because it's warming the ocean and guys, we don't have time for all that. But that was kind of all of that aspect and how organisms have adapted and evolved to surviving in those crazy depths.
Man.
Fascinating.
It
I
is.
Love the deep sea. Also, the episode of Blue Planet season 2, The Deep, you actually get to see a whale drop.
Oh, see, yeah, that's amazing.
And they
that's
filmed so cool. it over a matter of like 2 years.
It was several years ago, but the Long Beach Aquarium, the Aquarium of the Pacific, actually had a whale fall exhibit. Like, it wasn't a real whale, but they had recreated that ecosystem. So super
really?
Cool. It was like they had created a plaster cast of a whale, and they had put onto the bones different edible aspects, things that would occur at different stages of decomposition to see what kinds of organisms would grow and survive in a whale fall. It was really interesting.
Yeah, it's really cool because you see the whale fall, and the first creature usually that makes it to one, even in the deep sea, are sharks because their sense of smell is absurd.
Yeah.
And so they're fast and they can make it there. And sometimes sharks eat once a year. So they're there and they pig out. And mm-hmm. then it's like when they leave, it's like this guy comes in. Right. The eels come in. Yeah. And then when they leave, the manta rays. Right. It was just so cool how like they'll literally, you can almost see the animals like waiting on the outskirts because they're like,
when's
I'm
it my
also
turn?
The prey
my turn.
Of that guy. So I'm going to hang
wait.
Out over here.
I'm going to wait for him
when
to
they
clear
go,
out.
I'm going to be at the salad bar just waiting for the good stuff.
But then I'll be at the bar. Turn. You tell me when my table's ready.
Right.
Are we moving on to sea monsters?
I think so.
Yeah,
because some monsties.
I was going to say, like, the argument against sea monsters is that we would have found them by now.
Right,
which
right.
100% no, we would not have.
like, shut your damn mouth.
Ocean's big, guys.
We literally just talked about how we haven't explored enough right. of the ocean, how it's impossible to get down there. But also something that you were talking about, like the types of creatures that can exist in that deep sea. Creatures, in theory, get smaller and smaller the further down you go. And supposedly in the deepest parts of the ocean, especially places where the light can't reach, there's no way that there are fully formed growths of life, which is wrong again.
Mm-hmm.
There are more species in the deep ocean than anywhere else on the planet. There are fully grown fish that we know of. Mm-hmm. There are two types of crustaceans, the Malacostraca, thank you, which are like crayfish, crabs, lobsters, and shrimp, mm-hmm. and the Amphipoda, mm-hmm. okay, thank you. And there are 7,000 plus species in this group of crustaceans, and they are basically the ones without shells or mm-hmm. protective casings.
Right.
Okay. So honestly, they kind of look like what mites look like.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, exactly.
Under a microscope. Yeah, they're really ugly and awful. They're horrifying. Most adults, what do you call them? Amphipods?
Amphipods. Well, yeah, amphipods are just like,
okay.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Most of them wouldn't even measure to be an inch in length. They're basically like sea bugs.
So itty bitty.
They're like little sea buggies.
Yeah.
But that was until we started exploring the deep sea floor and we found some that are 14 inches long.
Stupid.
They are super giants and they get bigger and bigger the deeper we explore. Yeah. So,
see? So there are giant horrible things in the deep sea.
There could be enormous
and they're just waiting for their moment
yes.
to shoot up, eat
you
me first.
Specifically.
Yeah. They're going to eat me first and then they'll get to everybody
else. I'm going to put a ton of little like message in a bottles in the ocean with your address on it.
You're the rudest.
And then put little weights on them so you make sure they sink. Yes. Jesus.
Go down very far.
Oh my goodness.
So anyways, there could be enormous, gigantic,
huge things
down there.
Huge, horrifying things.
Well, I think I remember you guys talked on one of the nature episodes about like crazy parasites and all the weird shit mm-hmm. they do. And that's really, that stuff like freaks me out. But I remember in one of my many marine invertebrate classes, it's like you look under a microscope and they'd be like, what's this? I was like, guys, I don't fucking know. This tiny thing looks the same as this tiny thing. Yeah. And you have to identify which mouth part of the eye. I was like, oh, God. But we would talk a little bit about marine parasites because many of them are crustaceans. You know, they don't necessarily survive on their own, but they have some kind of protective covering. And I know you guys talked a little bit about it was at least one marine isopod, which is capable of getting into like
the
gills,
fish's eye.
The fish's eye.
Oh, yeah,
but
that
one of
was
them,
awful.
And I didn't bring it because I just, it was, it's not deep sea, but it's just, it would actually go into a certain species of fish's mouth and eat the tongue and then just sit there. And then instead of the fish eating
the
more
food,
you would open the mouth of the fish and there's a freaking deep sea bug staring at you with its eyes and super creepy. And it's just eating the food until the poor fish dies. And then this fucker just goes off to another
fish.
Bye.
Onto the next. Thank you, next.
It was that blew
Thank
my brains
next.
Because – and then for a while I remember like – I would be, you know, opening the mouth of a fish. I was like, please don't have a bug in there. Please don't. Please have your tongue. Because it was just like, ugh. Like you
what am I about
and
to
another
see?
Set of eyes is staring at
oh,
you.
No.
Like, I remember
That's
for a
so
while.
Bad.
And then after a while, I think I just forgot about it. I tucked it away. But whenever I think about it, I was like, I still don't want to.
Chills run
that's
down
like,
your spine.
That's where we get into like alien level shit.
Yeah, I was going to say that
yeah.
sounds
it
like something.
Like
that sounds like what if that's what happened to the xenomorph.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
with
exactly.
like a thing that comes out of his mouth. Uh-huh. Like the xenomorph is just so just angry like that. Because he's you. Hungry.
Yeah.
And his tongue eats all of his
food. My tongue takes my food. So I'm going to murder you.
Well, we talked about that a lot at the aquarium when we would discuss a deep sea. It's like, you know all that crazy shit you guys saw in the movies? This is where it came from. This is where that inspiration comes from. It's like, it does look that freaking weird and crazy.
It does look like a horror movie monster.
It does look like a horror movie monster. And so a lot of that inspiration comes from the deep sea. So it's, you know, that aspect of, well, you get the creative arts from it too. Because the abyss came from somewhere, guys. And that's a rad movie.
So this was actually a good topic for me to cover because I can pretend that they are definitely a myth.
Uh-huh.
And some of the ones I'm going to talk to today are very much legend, but I just thought they were interesting.
That you know of.
No, that allegedly. I have to pray are just myths allegedly. And legends. Says who?
That's all the time we have this week for Keep It Weird. Thank you so much for listening, and obviously thank you, Mel, for joining us on the show again. She is so full of knowledge, I can't even. If you ever have questions about the ocean, just shout out to Mel on Instagram at mermaidmellow. Join us next week for an extended episode of the show where we dive into sea monsters, real and mythological. And we get into some other real weird shit in the deep waters of the ocean. And while you're on Instagram following Mel, you can follow us at Keep It Weirdcast. We're on Facebook and Twitter as well. At Keep It Weirdcast is our handle across all platforms. We also have a YouTube page, which we're really going to be working on a lot this year. So just search Keep It Weird Podcast on YouTube for some bonus weird content, including our news segment, This Week in Weird. Weird, weird. Check out our Patreon page if you want to donate to the show and get cool shit like discounts on merch, bonus episodes, and monthly newsletters. If you want t-shirts, tank tops, hoodies, buttons, tote bags, or magnets, check out our Etsy page at www.etsy.com/shop/keepitweirdpodcast. As for the sign-off this week, I'm simply going to ask you to check out oceanconservancy.org and consider donating to their cause. They're a global movement to protect our oceans from pollution, overfishing, and ocean acidification. You can donate to Ocean Conservancy by heading to their website and setting up either a one-time donation or a monthly donation. It's super easy, and hopefully our science-packed episode that you just listened to helps you realize that the ocean is just as important for us land dwellers as it is for those of us who hang out under the sea. Enjoy my birthday, and keep it weird.
That looked good.
That was excellent.
That came through.
Perfect.
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.